Today's broadcast was originally recorded on December 17th, 2024.
Judge Juan Marchand in Manhattan ruled that the Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity has nothing to do with the Stormy Daniels case. It absolutely guarantees that on January 20th, the United States of America will lose its place in that line of serious countries that have never had a president who is a convicted felon.
Well, those days are over, aren't they? Maybe. Probably.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. On the social media site Blue Sky today, where you can and should find and follow me at the Brad Blog, as that's where I'm spending most of my social media time these days. On Blue Sky, the group called More Perfect Union, which describes itself as a nonprofit newsroom and media that builds power for working people, wrote, quote, breaking. The FTC has announced a new rule banning junk fees for tickets and hotels. This final junk fees rule bans bait-and-switch pricing and all tactics that corporations use to hide the total price of live event tickets, hotels, and vacation rentals. They go on to link to today's new announcement of the new finally finalized rule from the Biden administration's Federal Trade Commission, and they note, quote, Trump's incoming FTC chair, Andrew Ferguson, was the only vote against the new rule. Go figure.
Of course he was.
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
So it is that kind of thing that might make some roll over and think, well, that's it. We're screwed. We're screwed. There's nothing we can do. Trump's going to roll everything back. All the good things that were done under Joe Biden's administration are just going to be reversed, just rolled back. And it is true. Donald Trump is going to try. In an administration, as I want to discuss in a bit, that is going to be more corrupt than anything by 100 miles than we have ever seen before in this country. Nothing has come close. But none of that means that we have to sort of roll over and accept it. None of that means that we can't put up a fight in the opposition. And yes, frankly, I believe we have an obligation to do so, which I do want to take some time to talk about in a little bit. Today is the day that electors in all 50 states meet at their state capitals to officially cast their presidential votes in an election that Trump appears to have won by a narrow margin over the Democratic candidate Kamala Harris, just under 1.5% in the popular vote. So pretty close. But he once again, in the popular vote, failed to win a majority of that vote, with more Americans voting against Donald Trump than for him, which is something that we also should keep in mind in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead. Nonetheless, we've got an electoral college system for electing presidents, not a popular vote. And in the Electoral College, Trump will have won by 312 votes to 226 over Harris. That is also not a particularly huge victory, just six more electoral votes than Joe Biden won back in 2020. But a win is a win, and on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, Vice President Harris, as constitutionally mandated, will oversee a joint session of Congress, and those votes will finally be tallied and certified, barring any insurrection, making Trump officially the president-elect, which he is not just yet, despite the media calling him that. We don't on this program. Have you noticed, Des?
Yes.
Anyway, he's not that, but he will be, and then he will have his second inauguration as president on January 20th. He will, at that time, be the first convicted felon to ever be sworn in as president of the United States. Yes, that is what we have done. A New York judge pretty much guaranteed as much on Monday night, just minutes after we got off the air. New York Superior Court Justice Juan Merchan, at least for now, has not rolled over, at least not yet, as many others have already. He has decided to not obey in advance, it seems to me, to rising autocracy. Justice Juan Merchan, as the New York Times reports, rejected Donald J. Trump's argument that a recent Supreme Court ruling on so-called presidential immunity had nullified his criminal case in New York State, upholding the former and future president's felony convictions for falsifying records to cover up a sex scandal that, in order to unlawfully help him win the 2016 presidential election. The judge's ruling preserves, at least for now, the stain of Mr. Trump's criminal conviction, and if the decision withstands an appeal, Trump could become the first felon to serve as president. At this point, I think it's almost certain that he will, but we will see. The ruling in New York, which addressed the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to grant presidents broad immunity for all of their official actions, thwarted only the first of several legal maneuvers that Trump has concocted to try and clear his record of 34 felony convictions before returning to the White House. New York State prosecutors had argued that the Supreme Court's decision had, quote, no bearing on this state prosecution, noting that Trump was convicted of orchestrating a scheme involving a personal and political crisis that predated his presidency. But Trump's lawyers seized on a particularly contentious portion of the high court's ruling, which prohibited prosecutors from introducing evidence even involving a president's official acts, even in a case about private misconduct, which that's what this case was about. They argued that testimony from former White House employees during the trial had contaminated the verdict against Trump. In the first significant interpretation of that polarizing opinion by the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, the New York judge who oversaw the trial sided with prosecutors, concluding that the testimony by those White House employees centered on Trump's unofficial conduct, not his official conduct as president. The New York prosecutors, quote, use of these acts as evidence of the decidedly personal acts of falsifying business records poses no danger of intrusion on the authority and function of the executive branch. Judge Juan Merchan said in a 41-page decision, and even if the evidence was, quote, admitted in error, such error was harmless, he added, noting the, quote, overwhelming evidence of guilt introduced at trial. In covering the judge's decision today, TPM's David Kurtz offers the proper caveats, I think, by noting, quote, I want to be clear up front that the wins such as they are in the coming months, are likely to be small, incremental, and not very dramatic. But ignoring them entirely would be a disservice to the folks grinding to preserve the rule of law, to fight off MAGA's destructive impulses, expose Trump corruption, and otherwise hold the line against further erosion. With that, he goes on to summarize the ruling in Trump's Stormy Daniels hush money case on Monday by writing that Justice Merchan didn't just deny Trump's move to overturn his conviction on the grounds that some of the evidence introduced at trial was in violation of the Supreme Court's subsequent ruling on presidential immunity. Merchan eviscerated Trump's arguments and ruled in such a way that makes Trump's expected appeal quite a bit more difficult. In his opinion, the judge, he says, foreclosed every manner and form of argument that Trump made. Merchan ruled that Trump had failed to preserve most of his arguments by not raising them in a timely fashion, but the judge considered those arguments anyway. He then rejected all of them as not meeting the Supreme Court's standard for official presidential conduct. Merchan then went a step further and concluded that even if Trump's arguments satisfied the standard for official conduct, prosecutors had not intruded on the function and authority of the presidency and thus sidestepped the Supreme Court's frankly ridiculous and corrupt immunity protections. Protections for the presidency, which apparently the court just discovered in the U.S. Constitution this past June for the first time ever. Who knew?
It's a miracle.
As a final flourish, Kurtz observes, Merchan concluded that even if he was wrong on all of the above, the introduction of the challenged evidence was a harmless error in light of the, quote, overwhelming evidence of Trump's guilt in this case. It was, he says, a belt and suspenders and garter and braces decision by Merchan, shoring up every angle of attack that Trump might launch on appeal. Will it end the matter? Well, Merchan is still considering a separate Trump motion that the case should be dismissed because he won re-election. For that reason alone, it should be thrown out, Trump is arguing. Sentencing, in the meantime, in the case is forestalled for now. It still seems unlikely, writes Kurtz, that this case will ever produce any meaningful punishment for Trump. But let the record show that Justice Merchan is still holding the line where he can. And I will note today that former federal corruption prosecutor Randall Eliason, our friend, a frequent guest on this program over the years, noted that he is still calling on Merchan to sentence Trump, whatever that sentence may be, before he is sworn in on January 20th. Whether that happens remains to be seen. But for now, anyway, the judge in New York overseeing the first ever criminal prosecution and conviction of a U.S. president is indeed holding the line. So are the New York prosecutors who are representing the people of New York. Donald Trump is still, for now anyway, a 34-time convicted felon and likely still will be as he becomes the next president of the United States. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is opposing any effort to overturn the jury verdict. They have signaled a willingness, however, to freeze the case for 4 years while Trump holds office, a move that could end up indefinitely postponing his sentencing, according to the Times. Justice Merchan could rule as soon as this week on Trump's election-related dismissal bid, the fact that he was elected president, so he gets to get rid of all the cases.
He's very special.
In fact, Merchan has already paused the sentencing several times. Trump faces up to 4 years in prison, though if he is ever sentenced, we'll see. It is seen as highly unlikely that he'll receive anything near that in jail time, if he gets any at all. But the line, for now, at least in this case, in New York, is being held. He is the judge doing his part. We've got to do ours. So let's take a quick break here, and I want to talk about exactly that, along with an amazing story of Trump corruption that astoundingly has been barely even mentioned over this past week. That and Desi Doyen's latest Green News report is all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, the corruption of the new Trump administration is already underway. I mentioned on yesterday's show a new report from CNN finding that as of last week, 8 of Trump's announced nominees to cabinet positions and or their spouses donated an astounding more than $37 million to Donald Trump, to his campaign, or to its associated super PACs, essentially buying their way into top positions in the next administration. That remarkable $37 million number does not even include the well over a quarter of $1 billion that was invested by Elon Musk, whose fortune was built in no small part, by the way, on government contracting and funding.
Yep.
To help buy Trump's presidency for America and really for Elon Musk. And by his position of power within that presidency, Musk has been named to head up Trump's so-called Department of Government Ethics. I'm sorry, Government Efficiency. There will be no ethics here.
Definitely not.
Which is not actually a governmental department at all. It's made up. It's an advisory board, I guess, of sorts. Compare that $37 million, however, from the cabinet nominees given to Donald Trump by 8 cabinet nominees to the seemingly paltry $100,000 in donations to the 2020 Biden campaign or its associated super PACs donated by a dozen members of Biden's cabinet back in 2020. But as much as
$200,000, that was it?
$100,000.
Oh, man.
Pathetic, right? You're not going to buy a president with $100,000. Anyway, as much as I hate to say it, that is just the beginning of the unprecedented corruption that we are about to see. And in fact, as I note, is already underway in the new Trump administration. Last week, the New York Times offered an unsettling preview of sorts that got very little coverage elsewhere, it seems, of just how massive and unprecedented this corruption and abuse of power is that we will now see in the Trump administration, which leads to some thoughts that I've been pondering on how to think about all of this and how to act on all of this moving forward. And by the way, how not to act. So let's start here. According to the Times, Donald Trump's son, Eric Trump, flew across the world to headline a cryptocurrency conference in the United Arab Emirates last week and told thousands of enthusiastic attendees that he and his father, the incoming president, were effectively working in tandem to push crypto, a business sector that the family is now directly invested in. The message, the paper observes, was notable because it contrasted drastically with the promise that the family made when Donald J. Trump entered the White House 8 years ago to keep business and government operations separate, which they didn't do a very good job of, but you know what? They're not even going to pretend to try to do that anymore. Eric Trump said he had even phoned his father to celebrate when the price of Bitcoin, the most popular cybercurrency, hit $100,000 after his father announced that he intended to appoint a crypto-friendly lawyer as the new chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates the industry that the family now profits from, or at least it is supposed to. That has all likely changed now that a man who is actually being investigated by the SEC for cybercurrency crimes is actually being named by Trump to lead the SEC. So I suspect those investigations are going to quickly end after January 20. Quote, said Eric Trump, you're going to have the most pro-crypto president in the history of America, Eric Trump told the crowd at the conference in the UAE. Think about a president who isn't going to allow Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies to be overregulated and stifled. Translation, isn't going to allow Bitcoin to be regulated at all. Eric Trump made the remarks at the Bitcoin MENA 2024 conference. MENA stands for Middle East and Northern Africa, where he also promoted the family's new business venture called World Liberty Financial, which is a cryptocurrency platform. His comments to attendees signaled that the Trump family is more willing to publicly announce when the incoming president's governing role will steer into his personal investments, and that it is not as concerned as it was in his first administration about avoiding potential conflicts of interest or even the appearance of them. So, yeah, remember when Trump pretended to hand over his business to his sons during his first term, even though he never actually did? But at least he had the courtesy to pretend. This time they've made clear he's not even going to pretend. In his keynote speech at the conference, Eric Trump explained that his family had come to embrace cryptocurrency in part because many major financial institutions and other corporations stopped doing business with them entirely in the aftermath of the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol. Other featured speakers at the event included people like Steve Witkoff, a real estate executive and a golfing pal of Donald Trump's that he has also named to be his new Middle East envoy. As he says that he is already trying to negotiate new peace deals in the region, Witkoff also is simultaneously promoting World Liberty Financial, the Trump family's personal crypto platform, which the Witkoff and Trump families helped to create this year. So the Trump families and the Witkoff families created this World Liberty Financial where you can go and buy your Bitcoin. And now Witkoff has been named the Middle East envoy, traveling all around the Middle East, including this conference in the Middle East.
So it's kind of like a...
to let people know, hey, here's our business. If you'd like, never mind leaving a business card. He'll just leave the business if you'd like to make any purchases here.
So it's kind of like a one-stop shop for corruption.
That's it. You want to buy your way into the heart of the next American president? Please buy as much cryptocurrency as possible through their platform for doing so. Thank you. No one can stop you. And it won't even be considered unlawful corruption. In fact, it's encouraged by the new president and his family. At the conference, Eric Trump and Witkoff both met privately with Justin's son. He's a cryptocurrency executive who is also currently being investigated, targeted by the Securities and Exchange Commission on fraud charges. Who just 3 weeks after the election in November, Justin Sun invested in, you guessed it, World Liberty Financial to the tune of $30 million. If you can't beat him, pay him off, buy him off. That's what Justin Sun is doing. And it was good enough to meet with Eric Trump's son at this conference just weeks before Trump becomes president again. Also at this conference was Paul Manafort, but all the best people were there. Paul Manafort was there. He's Trump's 2016 campaign chairman. He was jailed for tax fraud, bank fraud, conspiracy, including filing false tax returns, failing to report foreign bank accounts, as he worked with Russian intelligence agents while running Donald Trump's first campaign. He, of course, was eventually pardoned by Trump for those crimes before he left office in 2021. Manafort also worked briefly with the Trump campaign this year as well, in case you're wondering whatever happened to Paul Manafort. Manafort said in his speech, quote, there's a lot of exciting times ahead For those of you who are celebrating the $100,000 Bitcoin, you're going to be celebrating much higher very soon, said Manafort. I bet they are. In his keynote speech, Eric Trump explained that his family had come to embrace cryptocurrency in the aftermath of the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol. Cryptocurrency, he explained, is a way to slam the door back in the face of major banks and financial institutions that distanced themselves from Donald Trump and the family business after that, just because, you know, they tried and failed to overthrow the U.S. government. How elite of those big banks. The attack, quote, the attacks on the family, the attacks on our company, the nastiness of the system, the hell they put us through, Eric Trump said, recalling the periods when his father was first in the White House and then after January 6th, which led to many companies dropping the Trump Organization as a client. Had it not been for those attacks, he said, now he's referring to the attacks on Trump, not Trump's attack on the American government itself. Had it not been for those attacks, I don't think my eyes would have been open to the crypto industry. Of course, that's because it's a largely unregulated market. It is used by money launderers, by drug kingpins, by foreign terrorists to move money without direct government oversight or the cooperation of the big financial institutions. So, of course, the Trump family loves this idea of cryptocurrency. And, of course, as the Time reports, off the main stage at this event in Abu Dhabi, a feeding frenzy was underway as crypto investors tried to gain access to people in Trump's orbit, some of whom paid as much as $10,000 for so-called whale passes, buying them special direct access to the speakers. Many of the speakers were people who have faced legal problems in the U.S., including the chief executive of Kraken, a company that has been sued by the SEC, and Chengpen Zhao, the founder of Binance, who recently completed a federal prison sentence for money laundering violations. They also spoke on the same stage, along with Eric Trump. Happy to be with you. In front of a packed room, Zhao credited Donald Trump for recognizing that, quote, crypto is a superior technology for money. He added, for the people who are in doubt, now Mr. Trump probably fixed most of the doubt. Lawrence Noble, who served for over a decade as a general counsel at the Federal Election Commission, said he could think of few precedents in American history to compare to this moment. He said, this is taking it to a different level. He now teaches law at American University. He said, this is a direct conflict of interest. We have not seen anything like this before, he said. We have moved so far away from the ethical norms of past presidents where they divested themselves of financial interests before taking office. Yeah, it sure does seem like it. It sure does seem like it, and it seems like this story paints it quite clearly, but how many of you have even heard about any of this? And I got to say, other than the Times story on this, I saw, like, no coverage.
Me neither. I saw just one headline, and then it was gone.
And now, I don't see and I don't read everything, but I did hear plenty about, oh, I don't know, Don Jr.'s new girlfriend and his ex-girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoy, being appointed as ambassador to Greece. I heard about that. That's fun. And not that that corruption is unimportant, but the son of an incoming president going out and directly hobnobbing with criminals and instructing them specifically how to curry favor with the incoming presidential administration and his family to the tune of tens of millions, hundreds of millions, likely billions of dollars in graft and corruption. Well, that does seem somewhat notable as well. Seems like we should have heard more about this story. Back to the Times here. President-elect Trump, as they describe him, was initially a crypto skeptic. He called Bitcoin a scam and said that it was designed to undermine the U.S. dollar. But he started to embrace crypto on the campaign trail this year as the industry spent more than $130 million backing both him and, in particular, congressional candidates. It was only in September, just 2 months before the presidential election, that Trump and his sons started up World Liberty Financial, the platform for investors to borrow and lend using cryptocurrencies. They unveiled a new digital currency called WLFI. That's catchy. That was immediately available for purchase, apparently, along with themselves. It got off to a rocky start. They wanted to sell $300 million of these WLFI tokens, which would have translated into a major windfall for the family. After about 2 weeks, however, it had only managed to sell $2.7 million worth, according to a securities filing. But then World Liberty Financial got a boost after the election in the form of a $30 million token purchase by, yes, Mr. Justin Sun, who Eric met with at the crypto conference. He has legal problems in the U.S., Justin Sun does. The SEC sued him and his company last year, accusing them of manipulating the digital currency market, which he has denied. His investment in World Liberty could ultimately result in a payment as large as $22.5 million to Trump and his family under a compensation agreement that entitles a Trump business entity to 75% of token revenue. So stop on by World Liberty Financial today. Make your investment. 75% of it goes straight into Donald Trump's pocket. While in the Middle East, Eric Trump is also scheduled to travel to Saudi Arabia to announce the start of a new real estate deal there with a branch of a Saudi-backed investment company. This, too, another sign of what the New York Times quaintly, and I would argue quite unhelpfully, downplays in their description as a, quote, more relaxed approach during this new administration to business ethics. It's not an unprecedented abuse of power. It's a more relaxed approach to business ethics. Well played, New York Times. Eric Trump, in his remarks, compared the deplatforming of the family business by some banks after January 6th to aggressive regulatory actions by the Biden administration, which has filed a series of lawsuits and criminal cases against crypto industry executives, including several who were present at the convention center. "I saw them come after you," Eric told them. "I saw them strip your bank accounts. I saw them cancel you like crazy," he said. He made clear that that era is over. Now, maybe that era is over for now with the incoming president and both his willingness to be as corrupt as he likes and the dispensation, the legal dispensation for doing so, that he has largely been granted by his already corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, which has largely said that he has complete immunity from anything that he does that is even, you know, close to the bounds of his official acts as president. He can do whatever he wants. He can be as corrupt as he wants. And by the way, Eric Trump just told a whole bunch of people how they can help get that new president on their side for whatever it is they want. But is using family business to collect essentially bribes of any amount from anybody and everybody in exchange for doing their bidding, is that within his constitutionally defined official acts as president? Well, to you and me, obviously not. To the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, well, who knows? Who knows? But even if it isn't, even if it's a bridge too far, even for that corrupt Republican majority on the high court, who's going to prosecute Trump for anybody for any of this? Trump's own Justice Department, run by Attorney General Pam Bondi? Really? Who's going to investigate? The SEC, run by a guy right now being investigated by the SEC for corruption? He's going to go investigate any of this? The FBI, headed up by Kash Patel? Really? I appreciate that for many, all of this can seem kind of hopeless right now. I get it. I understand. It can feel, as we discussed on yesterday's program, as, you know, billionaire heads of media and tech companies like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and ABC News are just rolling over in advance for Donald Trump. I understand that it can feel like we are all helpless here, like nothing can be done. The rule of law, democracy, it's over, it's done. Oh, well, we had a good run. That's that. So I certainly get it. And by the way, it certainly could be over and done. That's that. But none of that means that we need to go out without a fight. A lot of companies involved in cryptocurrency corruption run their businesses, for example, through states like New York, which is not barred from investigating and prosecuting crimes at the state level, as we were reminded on Monday night by Judge Juan Merchan's ruling in that New York case, where Donald Trump was found guilty of 34 counts of fraud. Democrats in Congress, though they're in the minority, they will still have voices that they can use in congressional hearings to highlight, to spotlight these gangsters and thugs, including Trump and his family, if they like. And I certainly hope that they do. People like me, apparently, still have access, at least for now, to at least some of our public airwaves to try to highlight what these thugs and criminals and goons are up to. And of course, we will continue to do so with your help. People like you have telephones that you can use to call your members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to let them know how you feel about things, to let them know that you expect them to stand up for our country and our democratic values and our Constitution, and that you will do everything within your power to hold them accountable at the next election if they do not. All of this is just a part of what it means to be the opposition, or the loyal opposition, if you prefer. To fight, to hold the line any way possible, to obstruct, to delay, to slow things down, to make things as difficult as possible, even when, and especially when, the odds are against us. Will all of this work? Well, probably not. Will some of it work? It probably will. But whether it does or doesn't, that's not up to us. What is up to us is whether we try. As historian and tyranny expert Timothy Snyder advised in his lesson one on how to oppose tyranny, quote, do not obey in advance. He says most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. Do not teach power what it can do. Do not obey in advance. Our friend Marcy Wheeler of Empty Wheel over on Blue Sky last week, she had a similar message in response to sort of a parade of people who are seemingly rolling over for Trump right now and his unbelievably corrupt and or completely unqualified nominees to key administration roles. As she wrote in a thread at Blue Sky that I'm happy to associate myself with, she writes, quote, you know, one way for you to obey in advance is to say, I can't affect what my Republican senator does. So I'll go on Blue Sky and I'll whine that they'll all comply in advance. When guess what? She notes they have already rejected two of Donald Trump's nominees, and they forced FBI background checks, at least in some cases. So, yes, you can do something, even if you have a Republican senator. She says, I see a lot of people claiming that entities, tech companies, senators, Europe, pissed off GOP judges will bow down, which is a good way to avoid doing work themselves. They sure as hell will bow down, she notes, if there is no counterweight. She says, your job is to ID points of friction and be that counterweight. But the reality, Marcy says, is all these entities are showing some pushback, or they might if consumer pressure is brought to bear, rather than making yourself maximally impotent by saying, oh, it's hopeless, nothing I can do. Figure out what you can do and at least try. Talking Points Memo's Josh Marshall shared a similar sentiment in response to those who are essentially saying, well, that's it, we're screwed, democracy is over. Nothing we can do. It's terrible. Well, it is terrible, but doesn't mean it's over. He describes that condition in a way that with a phrase that I can't actually say on FCC air, so I'm just going to call it militant pessimism. Use your imagination. I'll link to his full story when I post today's show at BradBlog. But he writes, as the clock winds down on the Biden presidency, Democrats and Democrat adjacent are hashing out, often awkwardly and painedly, what stance to take toward the second Trump presidency. He says there's a species of Democrat who imagines there's some power or badassery or even a species of courage in declaring constantly that Trump is all powerful and everybody else is powerless before him. That was playing out last week, Josh notes, in Trump's threat, for example, to jail the members of the January 6th committee after pardoning the insurrectionists themselves. He says, I'm with former Rep. Adam Kinzinger, whose response to Trump was, quote, bring it on. This isn't just about the personal and aesthetic importance of standing or going down fighting rather than cowering. He says there's also a deeper issue, which is how much fuel anyone should give Trump, how large a penumbra of fear and shock that we should allow Trump to cast with his boasts that he probably lacks the courage to make good on and would probably struggle to make good on if he were even up to trying. He says this isn't the same as ignoring these crazed and degenerate threats, and it doesn't mean that these threats could not come to pass. Managing that balance is at the heart of this period that we are living through. In discussing his conversations with some on Blue Sky and their tendency toward militant pessimism, he recognizes, as I do, that if someone is tapped out, overwhelmed, overcome by pessimism, I get that. It's that need that some people have to make an ideology of that sad saccharine, to propagandize for it. Where does that urge come from? That inside-out valor, he asks. For example, he notes, Donald Trump cannot just end birthright citizenship as he has promised to do. I think it was a week or so ago when he was on Meet the Press. Oh, yeah, I'm going to end birthright citizenship. We have to. He's going to do it with an executive order, apparently. Well, as Josh notes, it's right there in the plain text of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and that clear meaning has been confirmed and buttressed by 150 years of case law and attestations by the United States government. He can't just end birthright citizenship with an executive order. He can't do it. He can try. But he's going against 150 years of case law and the U.S. Constitution itself. Josh says it's very important to state these realities confidently and right in his face, which, by the way, Kristen Welker did not do. She let him make that comment and then just kind of moved on to the next thing. Josh writes, the guy is constantly operating within the territory of his boasts and trash talk, and it's his opponents who end up letting him do it. He says this doesn't mean he won't try to do this or that he won't find judges who will back him up. It's clear to me, he writes, that not a few people think that putting Trump to his test, saying, we'll believe it when we see it, champ, is the same as saying, well, nothing bad can happen. But that's not true. When Kinzinger says, bring it on, he notes, I'm pretty sure he's not saying, yes, I welcome you putting me in jail and I'll be pumped in jail. I think he's saying that knowing Donald Trump's cowardice and with his history of being all talk and little follow through, he doubts that Trump is up to it, but he will hit it standing on his feet regardless if he does. We need a lot more of that, Josh Marshall argues, and so do I. He notes we're in a worse place than we were 8 years ago, and in real, but by no means always, we're in a worse place than we were 4 years ago. As is always the case, we don't know where we will be in 4 years, but the range of possibilities right now is pretty wide. It's also the case that the American presidency has a lot of powers to it, especially if it's backed by a compliant judiciary and Congress. But the reality is that the American system is replete with levers oppositions can use to stymie and block and slow down and obstruct and reverse those very same powers. Anyone familiar with American history and the dispersal of power in American government knows this. Here, federalism, so often the bane of reformists, actually amplifies this reality to a great degree. There is a lot of governmental power in a lot of different places, like in the states. He notes, yes, there are no guarantees. Why would there be? But there are a lot of tools as well. It's easy to be overawed by talk and boasts and threats, but we don't need to be. He's right. And I'm not in denial, and I don't think that Josh is in denial either. I do realize how bad this could be, and frankly is likely to be in most cases. It's why I began this argument with that reporting on the Trump family in Abu Dhabi explaining how easy it is to buy them off with cryptocurrency purchases for any amount they like. And there's really little that I can figure out to do about it. I'm sure there's something that can be done about it, but I don't know what it is. Like I said, maybe in New York, maybe law enforcement officials in New York can look at what is going on and bring charges at the state level. Why not? There's 49 other states that could do the same if they wanted to. So, yeah, I'm not in denial about what's happening here and how bad this is going to be. And all of this is going to happen. It's going to be bad. But what are we going to do about it? That is the question. Rolling over and giving in because it all seems just so overwhelming now. Well, to me, that's not an option. Just giving in is not an option. Now, listen, I get it. I do know that we are all exhausted. I know that I am. I'm crawling over the finish line here until we get to the holidays. It's one of the reasons that, frankly, we are taking a longer than ever, break over the holidays beginning next week. I think that it's not all because we're exhausted, but yes, it's because of the way the dates come in the year, but the holidays. But yeah, after this past year, it has been exhausting. And knowing what is coming up, well, I think we need some rest.
Yes.
I think we need some rest. I think we all do.
Rest up.
And so I hope you will forgive us for that. But listen, knowing what is coming after this past year, we desperately need that rest. We all do. Somehow, before the new year, before the new session of Congress, and before the new presidency. If you need that too, please, I hope you get it. And I hope that you will. Take as long as you need, because we're going to need everyone in this fight. But whenever you are ready, as Marcy says, figure out what you can do and at least try. When you get your sea legs again, we'll all be here and we will need you in that good fight. And no, we are not going to win them all, and maybe we won't even win many of them. But I would rather go down fighting. And 250 years of fighters who came before us, well, I think we owe it to those who fought and died for what we are now asked to defend from a buffoonish, corrupt clown and his family any way that we can figure out how to do so. I won't call it militant optimism, but I know it ain't going to be militant pessimism. Not on my watch. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Desi Doyen, it seems to me that you have been fighting this fight now for about 15 years, whether it's a Republican administration, Democratic administration. The fight for climate change has been like kind of feels like a losing battle. what you're up against over all of these years. So maybe you got an idea of what I'm talking about.
Physics is impervious to political parties and political ideologies. It is what it is. And I've learned that pessimism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I'm done with that.
You're done with the pessimism. All right. Glad to hear it. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
I was screaming because I could see the end coming for me.
Cyclone Chido unleashes, quote, apocalyptic devastation on Indian Ocean archipelago. Malaria and other diseases are on the rise again around the world thanks to worsening extreme floods. Plus,
the knowledge that these chemicals are carcinogenic has been with us for a very long time.
Biden's EPA finally succeeds in banning cancer-causing chemical.
Finally, all of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
What seems clear is that Trump is purposely appointing people who promised to destroy the thing they've been appointed to run. Next, he's going to replace Smokey the Bear with Flamo the Arsonist.
And do you think he won't? Get ready. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the year is winding down, but the effects of climate change are doing no such thing.
Sadly, that is true. Aid is being rushed to the Indian Ocean island of Mayotte near Madagascar, where powerful cyclone Chido hit over the weekend. Chido was the worst cyclone to hit the island in nearly a century, fueled by exceptionally warm ocean waters, and caused, quote, apocalyptic widespread destruction across the French territory. Authorities warn the death toll from the Category 4 equivalent storm is likely to be in the hundreds, potentially thousands. The storm's devastating impacts are the latest reminder that the poorest nations are being hit first and worst by the consequences of man-made climate change caused by the burning of fossil fuels. The storm hit as the International Court of Justice at The Hague wrapped up 2 weeks of historic hearings on the existential crisis that climate change is imposing on low-lying island nations. They are asking the court to determine the legal responsibilities of wealthy, polluting nations to address the climate crisis that those nations created and to pay for damages. Here's the Attorney General of Tuvalu, whose nation is projected to be the first to disappear beneath rising seas.
Tuvalu may soon become uninhabitable. In these circumstances, there can be no question that our fundamental right to self-determination is being violated.
The World Court will publish its findings next year. A new study finds that malaria killed nearly 600,000 people around the world last year and is resurgent, due in part to worsening extreme flood events. The report warns that after years of decline, the global tally of malaria cases rose for the fifth consecutive year this year, exacerbated by the increase in extreme storms and flood disasters that create breeding grounds for insecticide-resistant mosquitoes, while also disrupting access to health care.
Well, don't worry your pretty little head about it. Donald Trump has a top-notch health team ready to take over the reins next year.
That's what I'm worried about.
Uh-huh.
In Europe, an historic ski resort in Lucerne, Switzerland, says it will close indefinitely due to lack of snowfall. The resort's owners cited data from Switzerland's weather service showing that as winter warms, precipitation now falls more frequently as rain rather than snow, severely shortening their ski season and making it harder to remain open while also disrupting the region's winter tourism economy.
Yeah, can't fight Mother Nature, especially a climate change Mother Nature. nature.
But there is some better news.
Good.
The European Union's crackdown on air pollution has had significant benefits for public health. New data from the World Heart Federation has found that since 2010, the EU's steady reduction in fossil fuel use also reduced air pollution, and in turn, deaths from heart disease triggered by pollution fell 20%. Pollution-related deaths from stroke fell by more than 25%. Here in the U.S., late last week, the Biden-Harris Environmental Protection Agency finally succeeded in banning two solvents known as TCE and PCE for short that are used in dry cleaning and household cleaners and can cause cancer and other serious diseases. The chemicals are the focus of thousands of lawsuits involving drinking water contamination, including at Camp Lejeune. The new rule requires manufacturers to rapidly phase down production, imports, distribution, and most uses of TCE starting in January. The ban protects neighborhoods near TCE manufacturing plants as well, like a Minneapolis facility that emitted unsafe levels of TCE into the air for years. And finally, the Biden administration also released another tranche of funding from the Inflation Reduction Act, nearly $800 million, to help communities replace thousands of polluting diesel-powered heavy trucks. The vast majority of the funding will go to school districts in 27 states and two tribal nations to shift to all-electric school buses to reduce children's exposure to toxic air pollution.
And all not a moment too soon. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Not a minute too soon.
Not a minute too soon, indeed. And by the way, one of the things we've been talking about Donald Trump is planning to do to reverse all of those things that the Biden administration did when it comes to climate action and everything else. Yeah, he's probably going to try. We'll see how he does that, too. We can stand in opposition of any way possible, if only by letting you folks know about it right here on the Green News Report and the Bradcast.
Exactly.
We got to get out. My thanks to Desi Doyen and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those very few of you who hit a donate button when you stop by, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay and continue the fight over your public airwaves. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You'll find me on the social medias, including Blue Sky at The Brad Blog. You'll find Desi there as well. She is
Green News Report.
That's it. We'll see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.